We'd all be less cranky if we just adjourned and came back on August 15th. I think it's probably
okay.
And thank you, Senator Durkford and Senator Bryant, for coming over and offering your thoughts on these two bills, Senate Bill 1181 and 1180. And we'll just turn it over to you.
Thank you. My name is Neil Bryant. I'm a senator from District 27, Central Oregon. And beside me, of course, is Senator Durkford from Salem. We are the two sponsors of 1180 and 1181, and I won't go into the specifics of the bill, and will allow the Oregon School Board Association to allow that specificity and also give their examples and reasons of why the bills are needed. But in general terms, what Senator Durfer and I attempted to do from 1995 is to review our collective bargaining laws and to try and bring what we consider balance back to those laws, and at the same time allow local control. And in 1995, we passed Senate Bill 750, and the governor signed it into law, and that dealt with collective bargaining in a very general way, in that it included not only education employees, but also state employees, public safety employees, and it was the first review of our collective bargaining act since 1973. And we made some changes in there that specifically addressed education bargaining, especially as it related to mandatory permissive subjects to bargaining and when to bargain and those sorts of things. And they were good changes. But what we attempted to do was be responsive to the Oregon School Board Association and local school districts, where over the past 28 years, they feel that they're no longer able to bargain successfully, collectively, and what the legislature has been providing is more strength to the school board through legislation, things that frequently that they've lost through the collective bargaining process. And this leads you then to the question, well, can local school districts bargain effectively with a statewide teachers union? And I say statewide, even though I know that each district has a local school district and bargaining team, but it's a statewide system. It's 27 UNISERVs. It's training statewide, and they're my hat goes off to them. They are very good, and they operate within the law, and they're frankly better and more effective than local school boards. And the reason, to a large extent, is local school boards are made up of volunteers, people interested in education who give up their time, and they're not skilled expertise or have the expertise to really participate in what is a very adversarial, can be very adversarial situation dealing with collective bargaining. And so the issue that I think we're going to have to face over the next 2 years is whether or not to go to statewide collective bargaining. Senator Durfer and I have always opposed that and tried instead to strengthen local school boards. And I'm coming more and more to the conclusion that that isn't going to be successful, because by strengthening local school boards and saying this is then what you have to do from a legislative perspective, we're eliminating some of that local control, and maybe we should just go ahead and do statewide collective bargaining on the economic issues. This argument is strengthened by the fact that in the future, we're probably going to provide 80% of the funding for K-12. And if that's true, shouldn't we have control on how the dollars are spent? And that's where Senate Bill 1181 comes in. As we approach session, and we've seen that we've gone from a locally funded school district system to a state-funded system, we look for other examples of how to address that, and in particular, how to control the spending. Because we thought it'd be better to plagiarize some other state's good idea than Senator Durfer and I trying to come up with our own idea. And the state of Wisconsin had passed in 1993 what was called the Qualified Economic Plan, and they were facing some of the same issues the state of Oregon. And it was Tommy Thompson, a Republican, was governor, but the legislature was Republican, and excuse me, Democrat, so it's just the reverse of what we had. And they came up with this Qualified Economic Plan, which was in the first draft almost verbatim of 1181. That's been modified by some changes that tried to address some of the concerns of the governor and of education. And what you have before you today, it includes all spending by school districts and not just spending related as it relates to teachers. And the purpose is this, that we need to have some control on the total amount spent. Otherwise, we'll budget for education, whether it's 4.6, 4.7, 4.8, 4.9, whatever it is. And that will be our expectation as a Ways and Means process and as a legislature. But there's no control on the local districts on how much they contract for. And in the past, they exceeded that current service level of what we budgeted for them. And then they come back and say, we need additional money over and above the current service level because we've made commitments, we've signed contracts. If you don't give us the money, we'll have larger class size. We'll have to make these other cuts. We can't prepare the roof. We can't buy books. Our technology is failing, those sorts of things. And so 1181 is our attempt to say, here's how much money you have to spend. You decide how to spend it. But if you go over that amount, then one, you have to report publicly how this is going to affect programs. You're going to have to report to the legislature how it's going to affect you. If a school district wants to stay within those parameters, they can just basically lay that offer on the table, and then that will satisfy those economic issues. That's in very general terms the parameters of 1181. And it may not be perfect, and we're certainly open to other suggestions, but we think it's irresponsible for us not to try and control how or the amount that's spent at the local level. We do that in everything else we find, and we should have some control as to what we do here, especially when it's going to be over 50% of the year. So in philosophical terms, in general terms, that's what we were trying to accomplish.
Thank you. Jim Drucker, Senator from District 16 here in Salem. Neil has covered quite a bit about the reasons for these measures that were introduced. I think 1180, we had to, we did 880 the last session. We found some things that probably didn't work as well as we thought they should. And so there's a couple of adjustments in there to make the process work smoother. There is, as you know, we thought we had corrected the just cause last session, and now we find that the OEA decided to work around that by bargaining that in the local school districts, which was not the intent of 880 when it was passed. Certainly they have a right to do that, but we feel that they have plenty of protections and plenty of reasons for how they can make the process work under the rules we thought. And Neil talked a little bit about the school boards and the power, and I know when you hear the union talk, they sound as if they come in and sit down and everybody holds hands and they decide on the budget and what salary increases are going to be. But that's really not the way the system works. I have several letters from school board members of how they got harassed, how their businesses were threatened, how their students were threatened or in school. So it's not a very pretty process if you are really involved in the process and negotiating them. I would tell you that, like Neil did, most of the school board members that run for school board are interested in good education for kids. They're not interested in getting into these hassles that are required in the bargaining process. So we're hoping, and you know, you can say, you know, management can always correct these problems. When you have people who are volunteers who are not really professional, up against professionals, that makes it very difficult to bargain, I think, a good contract. Talk a little bit about the salary cap and the threat and other things that we're going to eliminate bargaining. I don't agree with that because there will be a percentage set by DAS that will be adequate. That will be adequate for funding for the dollars that we may have and still allow for the the normal increases in steps and so on. But and in cases where the school boards are going to negotiate within those parameters, I don't think they will need to invoke the qualified economic offer. In fact, I think it was in Wisconsin, they only implemented like 20% of the time. But it was a tool that was there that they knew that it was there. If you get a negotiating process that goes outside those parameters, you need to have something to control it. There is the incentive to control it because, as Neil said, they negotiate the contract and then they bring us the bill. And there is another method, and it's something that I think we certainly have to look at, and it would be statewide collective bargaining if that's the way the process is going to work. I would hope that we could leave the control at the local level, but you do have to give the school boards an artificial spine to resist this bargaining process if we're going to allow it to stay at the local level. If that doesn't work, I think the next step will be we'll have to take a look at it statewide. And I know the school boards will have an opportunity to probably go through the bill with more detail on the appealing events. That's kind of where we are in the bill.
Thank you. Mr. Gardner. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senators, both of you described this as some sort of process where these, you know, professional negotiators for the teachers will get these four public school board members, don't the school board members in fact hire professionals in the negotiating process and don't they in fact
the school boards themselves do the negotiating. I know that, like Ron Wilson will be talking to him, talk about negotiating.
But they hire professionals.
Most school districts do. They either hire someone like Ron Wilson from the Oregon School Board Association, or there are three or four attorneys that specialize in collective bargaining, and they are employed by most districts. Some do it on their own, but usually they're the very small ones. The point is that the school board members, and they're usually involved in the negotiations, and of course as the negotiations go on and you reach impasse, mediation, strike notices, those sorts of things, it involves the school board. And the pressures that are then created, most school boards are unsuccessful in withstanding those pressures. And that's the system we set up. I just said it's not illegal, but that's what happens. This is an effort to, as I call it, restore some of the balance. It's also an attempt not to go to statewide collective bargaining, because I think with the pressures we're under and the battles we have every day on ways and means, that we would be less susceptible to those pressures than a school board.
Even though they perhaps have negotiators, I talked to several of the school board members from firm risk that just went through the strike, and the feelings that they had about what happened, most of them would not run for school board again. After going through that process.
But there's probably a lot of teachers who wouldn't want to continue teaching in the process, particularly if these were implemented as well.
Well, it depends on what you mean by, I still go back, we pay the teachers higher than any of the 11 Western states. We're not really that bad in how we pay teachers, in my opinion. Do we pay teachers enough? I'd say good teachers, we don't pay enough. Poor teachers, we probably pay too much. But it is a socialistic system where everybody gets the same amount regardless of how they produce. And that's a system that's been developed and used for years. I don't particularly think that's a good system, but that's what we live with.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Gershwin, Senator Bryant. The bill is directed principally at economic issues. What's your reaction to the argument about should this offer be made, and it basically closes off bargaining? If there are a lot of issues beyond economic issues that are normally dealt with in bargaining, some mandatory, some permissive, and this would basically potentially close the door towards resolving those issues between basically labor and management. I just want to get you that.
I think the language issues in the contract would become more focused, more important if the qualified economic offer was made, because I think that would allow the union to
concentrate on those areas and put more pressure to get concessions on that language. That's speculation on my part, but I think that would be what I think would happen looking in my crystal ball. So I think they would become, in that area, probably more contentious, more adversarial.
I would agree with that. I don't think it doesn't eliminate the ability to bargain for those issues.
Second question, although we're not debating that here today, the issue of statewide bargaining. My perception, I've been through a couple of situations where governments have merged. My belief, if you ever had statewide bargaining, is that compensation levels would rise to the basically the highest level of frontier protection.
I think the tendency would be to do that because it's, what's that old analogy that everything rises to the, I've only got half of it here, but it's easier to come up than it is to go down. So probably this would be similar to what happens in equalization in education. And of course, it makes it easier now that we have equalization in education as far as what we're funding per student, that there would probably be some stop districts, there would be some class, and however the terminology and the definition would be in your equity district until you came to a common level. Other states that have tried, who are in statewide, it hasn't been easy. Washington has a statewide system as it relates to economics, and it was more painful for the urban school districts who had higher salaries and were frozen at those for a number of years until the rules got up. So that's not a perfect system either. And as I said, Senator Durfler and I have resisted going to statewide collective bargaining. But if we're going to provide most of the funding, we being the general fund, that there's more of a tendency to head in that direction because naturally the people in this building will want to control how the dollars are spent. And that's an issue that's going to continue to be debated. But my hope is this is implemented or something similar to it, and it restores that balance I talked about, and we can still do it locally.
Thank you. I'm curious, given your testimony, why you don't have a statewide collective bargaining bill in front of us.
Well, you know, we looked at that. In fact, we did quite a bit of studying on it. Neil mentioned that the only state that I knew of other than Hawaii and Washington, there's two provinces in Canada that do it. And if we talked to those groups of people, Washington has a little different program in that the state pays for a basic school support, but they're able to get money at a local level to supplement that. We don't have that ability. We do have the local option, but a lot of the districts are already at the $5 cap. And so there wouldn't be a lot of money to be had by using the local option. I think that Hawaii is just one single school district, so you really can't use that as a comparison. Talk to people in Canada, they've used it for quite some time. I think British Columbia's had it now for 4 years. They have their problems with that also. It's not an easy system to develop. I don't think we can come with a statewide collective bargaining without doing a lot of study on it, how to implement it and how to do it. Because, like you mentioned, how are you going to pay everybody the same? And you basically say, well, since we're paying every student the same, you should pay every teacher the same. So, there's going to be a lot of pressures and a lot of things we have to consider, the cost of living, transportation, all of those things that different school districts have. Like small school districts have those small classes. It was difficult if they had to pay the high salary for teachers to keep a complement of teachers. So there's a lot of things you're going to have to look at before you can do a statewide collective bargaining. I think it's something that we probably are going to have to start looking at perhaps in the general. I don't like to go to statewide collective bargaining. I think local districts really do a better job of controlling the spending. But again, the pressures that they get just don't allow them to do a good job.
Alba?
Yes, it's in there.
As an alternative to that, we have the letter from Gene Thorne, dated June 22. I assume it's similar to some letter you may have received during dependency of the Senate. There were the governor's dietary amendments which were considered in the Senate and which were rejected. And this letter emphasizes the importance that the governor attaches to those amendments. It doesn't say that the governor would not sign the bill, but raises that question for the citizens. They think those amendments are needed. What is your reaction to the idea of putting those amendments into the bill?
We looked at those and said they really have no teeth. It just says you ought to do this, and that's kind of what it says. I think that at least some of the changes that we made would put some teeth into it, not a great deal, but some. And I would like to ask you, I think it's on line 28, page 2, there was a sentence in there about judging teachers, compare teachers about
the evaluation part.
Yeah, the evaluation part. That seems to cause more problems than anything. I would recommend you probably take that out. Any good administrator is going to be doing that in any way. I don't think it's something you have to add in the bill. It seems to raise more problems if teachers in that profession don't seem to be willing to be judged or compared measured for anything. But I think any good administrator probably will already be doing that, I think.
And it's important to note both in 8080 and 1180, the bill on renewal contracts addresses not only your certified staff but also your administrators. And certainly some problems we have in education are the result of poor administration. It's not a...
I would go more than that. I would say the biggest problem we have in schools is administrators, because teachers only do what administrators ask them to do. But I think the problem we have there is that school boards don't back up their administrators. That's really where the problem is.
One final general statement, if I can make. We have a very good educational system. We're in an age of transition, both in the way we control it. We have the Escape the 21st Century Act. That's challenging. The SIM and the CAM, very aggressive. New programs have a lot of anxiety, and then put pressures that teachers have to be not only good teachers, but also role models, supporters of sexual abuse, all those other things. And both of our wives are teachers. So, unfortunately, this in the rhetoric has been called teacher bashing. It's not intended to be that. It's intended to help improve education. And I know that teachers don't want to have poor administrators. It reflects badly on them and education. Likewise, they want to have good teachers and motivated teachers that are with them. And the vast majority of people in education teach because they love kids and they're good at it. And so, these bills are not intended to be demoralizing, and I'm sorry if they are, if they're viewed that way, but that's certainly not the intent.
I would agree with that. You know, I get calls, I get a lot of good letters and a lot of bad letters because the legislation was introduced, but I get quite a few letters from people saying, thank goodness you're trying to do this, because I'm not supporting schools, I'm not voting for additional school dollars, because of the system that we presently have. And I think if we can correct that and the public can see that we're serious about making sure that we have good teachers that are paid, that there'll be more, they will more apt to be supportive of education. And believe it or not, that is another issue that these kinds of things are going to correct, I think.
I appreciate you bringing this forward. And the problems are easily recognizable that we're trying to address here. And I know there is some consternation from individuals, particularly teachers and their labor representatives about both these bills. But being upset about the bills doesn't address the problem. And the problem is recognizable, and we have to find an answer. Has those individuals or anyone else suggested other solutions outside of the obvious, let's say, like a bargaining answer, any other answers to the problem that we're addressing here?
Well, the governor's office and Gene Thorne has proposed some amendments and ideas, and they basically follow what we offered, but as the senator said, there aren't any teeth to it. They're just asking the districts to do it without a way to enforce something if they don't, or publicize the fact that they're not falling within the guidelines and what impact that has if you have to make reductions in programs. So that proposal is on the table, but that's the only one other one that Senator Griff or I have seen.
There's nothing else from labor?
We have not seen anything from labor.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Edwards actually had a question. We'll come back over here.
Thank you. Thank you for coming today. I've been trying to get a handle on how this thing is really going to work. And then I can comment about the balance issue. But when you talk about some sort of growth factor, have you anticipated what that would be? Is that something you're looking for as far as what?
I don't think we have any set figure. We started out with a 3.8 or something in that area. Right now we're saying let the DS set the figure. It could be 3.8, it could be 6.5, it could be 9.6. They'd have to take a look at what the expected dollars are going to receive over the next 5 years, and they would give some projections that could change it each year. But it would give the school boards at least a goal to address in their budget negotiations. If they knew that it was going to be a 5.6 or 3.8 or whatever it might be, then they could negotiate those and hopefully still leave enough money left for books. And that's one of the most complaints I get is that from the parents is that you are using books that are 8 or 9 years old. And it's because we don't budget any money for books and supplies. But if the school board knew exactly a good idea of what they were expected to get over the next 5 years, they could start probably doing a better job of budgeting.
And on the 3.8, that came out of Wisconsin. And I asked Wisconsin how you came up with that figure in 1993. And it was a political compromise. And it was such a hotly contested and debated bill and issue that they haven't revisited it since then. So they've just left it at 3.8, like we sometimes do. Maybe it should be adjusted half point one way or another, but the battle isn't worth it. We thought we'd take some of the politics out of it in the amended 1181 by allowing DAS to set the figure rather than the legislature. But certainly, every 2 years, you can open that up again and argue what would be a fair amount and what it should be, just like we do now with the rest of the general fund and going through the ways and means.
An issue was raised yesterday, and obviously being from an urban area, I've always had a concern about this, and that is differentials in cost. Do you anticipate, and again, assuming that this is just sort of the one number fits all, may not work. And I think from my perspective in my district, that has been a problem, for example, with the formula. You may not agree with that, but I'm just saying, how do you incorporate differentials around the state, labor market, costs?
I think that would have to be adjusted in the formula. And then, of course, the increase, if, as exactly, your district was getting more dollars for the education system, and it went up to 5.3 or 3.8, whatever the DS shows, would increase it by that amount. So that would, again, it would say, I would think that would take care of the adjustment.
Also, we have had discussions about the formula. Having to have a separate pool of money for some consideration for high growth districts.
Mm-hmm.
And some modifications and tinkering in that way.
Just one last thing, more of an observation. I mean, it's just an interesting debate because I think there is a problem in some part that's been our problem, and that's how we budget here relative to school districts having to budget away for us. We're on biennial budgeting, their annual. There are some things that are out of sync. What I find hard to grapple with this is this sort of rebalance that you described, Senator, about trying to bring back some balance. I'm interested to hear from the school board because what I've been hearing from school boards has always been, where's the local control? Where's the local ability to define our destiny? This seems to me like you're taking it that completely away, and by saying the state says, you have now one. Well, you have an option not to do this, obviously. And I'm still not quite sure how, if you don't do it, you do this reporting, what happens as a result of that. But you're saying that basically you have an option not to basically give yourself any control, and here's you don't have to work with the local conditions or local bargaining unit. You can just sort of do your, here's this will fix your problem. And it may not, but I guess it seems to me it's like going the exact opposite way, at least from the local control issue, which is now we've got a state percentage that we have concocted that says, hey, this will fit you, take it, and you can use it. I don't know. I'm still wrestling with just that first.
And that's the evolution. And it is a change from local control, local funding to schools, to certainly more state funding and more state control. And with the dollars flow the control, I don't know how we're – that's what we do. And that's logical because it adds to the accountability. If they really want the local control, what we have to do is change the way we finance schools again and go back to a local funding base. And what that also adds, and I remember this for almost 20 years in Bend, you know, every year we'd go out for a new tax base or a new bond levy, and we'd form committees, and half the time we're successful, half the time we failed. But that added local accountability. It, I think, did a better job in the collective bargaining area, too, because people knew if you didn't get that thing passed, the dollars weren't there. It involved the community locally. Don't have that right now, because there are no local elections except for capital improvements, and you just pass on the concern to the state. If you grant that extra 1% in costs, roll-ups, whatever it is, that's not your fault, because the general fund will pick up.
That isn't our check, in a way. Whatever budget we pass is sort of a signal about how far we're willing to go. We have that control ultimately by saying how big the budget is. So in a sense, we do have that back stuff.
Except, and then the real pressure comes, we sign these contracts, and we have to live by them because they are valid contracts. So if you don't give us this amount of money, which is over and above the current service level that's projected, then we're going to have to lay off teachers and increase class size, not repair buildings, no new textbooks. And we have no control over that right now.
Representative Byer.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just curious, the number 3.8, 5.6 were thrown out. In your committee, did you have DAS come in and give any testimony for what they think the number in Oregon would be as the bill reads in Section 3 right now?
We did not. But they should be able to establish, they should be able to take a look at the economic conditions and say, this should be what, you know, the real rate of forecast of what we're going to get 2 years from now in our budget. And you could do that out 5 years very easily, a projection of what the growth of the state's going to be. And by that growth factor, we know what the general fund's going to be. So you could allocate so much for the schools. And it, yeah, it's going to be a guess. But that can be adjusted each biennium. At least they would have some idea of what the growth factor is that they could include in the budget.
But you can't answer that question right now.
So what kind of a figure do you ask would come up with?
Yeah.
I think what we've asked in the bill is to take a look at economic conditions and project what the growth would be.
Yeah. In private conversations with John Yunker, dealing with when we threw in the 3.8, which I said comes from Wisconsin, there was no science involved in that. When we plagiarized the bill, we plagiarized everything, apparently, and left out the independent thinking on what it would be under this economic condition. And of course, in 93, interest is higher, cost of living is higher, those sorts of things. And so John's initial comment was, well, 3.8 in this economic climate is generous. You know, that might not be the figure, but he didn't, at that point, have done the analysis and offered a different one.
If you look at, I think at least the Republican control of your proposed budget is 8.5% increase in education funding.
For
the
biennium.
For the PC or whatever.
I believe that's correct. Mm-hmm. And we do have members of the committee. We do have Sarah Gates from DAS, who's an economist who's involved in calculating this here, to answer questions that you may have.
Well, thank you for your time and enjoy the struggle.
Thank you very much.
Fascinating.
John?
Ron Marshall and Ron Wilson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association. And with me this afternoon is Ron Wilson, who is OSBA's Director of Labor Relations Services. Ron, in his career with OSBA, has negotiated probably in excess of 125 collective bargaining agreements, and is probably one of the four or five individuals in the state that know Oregon's Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act as well as anybody. With your permission, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to have Ron share with you our testimony on Senate Bill 1180, highlight some of those provisions, some of the provisions of that bill, and the rationale for our support. And then I'll talk a little bit about Senate Bill 1181, and then we'll both respond to your questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. My name is Ron Wilson, Director of Labor Relations with the Oregon School Board Association. Senate Bill 1180 does a number of things. First and foremost, it does provide an enhanced accountability link between expectations of both administrator and teacher performance and the results of our education system, which is indeed student achievement. And it does require, as part of an evaluation, that some type of an assessment be done about the effectiveness of a teacher or an administrator in producing those results in student achievement. It does not specify the nature of the assessment, nor does it specify the manner in which that assessment is to be conducted, but it does require an assessment for all school districts, for all administrators, and all teachers. The next major part of Senate Bill 1180 makes some changes to the collective bargaining law. Specifically, it makes the process, as well as the criteria for teacher dismissal and contract non-renewal, a permissive subject to bargaining. The effect of that is that it would prevent a Fern Ridge-type strike. A permissive subject to bargaining is such that it is an unfair labor practice to strike over that particular subject. It also raises the issue of what process should be used for the dismissal of teachers. We currently have the statutory processes in effect, but we also allow under the statute for districts and local education associations to bargain some different type of process. The heart of the Fern Ridge strike was a difference of opinion over whether a teacher should be dismissed and then have that appeal go to a private arbitrator or to the public system under the Fair Dismissal Law. The changes in Senate Bill 1180 say that, number one, you can't bargain away the right to go to the fair dismissal process. And it sets up that process as it currently exists with a panel of three individuals, a member of the public, a school teacher, or in the case of an administrator, and a school board member. The process also identifies in this bill that there is an arbitration alternative to this fair dismissal process, but that arbitrator would be selected from a group of hearings officers pursuant to House Bill 2525, which again is a public process as opposed to a private arbitration process through an individual labor agreement.
Ron?
Yes, sir.
How many teachers have been dismissed as a result of Senate Bill 1180 last year? Just ballpark, or is it bring me, you know?
I can get you the exact figure, but the ballpark is, I think about 30 teachers statewide were non-extended, and less than 1% is the number I've got in my head.
And how many teachers statewide?
How many?
Yeah.
30,000.
How many teachers are statewide?
How many teachers are there statewide?
Yeah.
There's about 33,000.
30, so the effect has been very, very minimal.
The effect has been very small, yes.
Very small.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Well, I don't think the intent of the bill was to put all 30,000 on notice that they may lose their job. So I'm not sure that's a fair analysis there.
Not much. I get it. My comment. And thank you for clarifying that for me.
Maybe it was.
It was. out of 100, if you have one out of 100 that you find is performing below standard, that tells me we've got a pretty good bunch of teachers overall. Excellent. But at the same time, the administration needs some tools to use to weed the garden as necessary.
Yes, I agree. Just continuing on the description of the bill, the bill also provides that some clarification that a program of assistance for improvement of remedial action demand is required for contract teachers, but not for probationary teachers during their probationary period. That also allows administrators to exercise some discretion on when to administer that program of assistance for improvement rather than being limited to four statutory reasons. Another major section of the bill is that assures that the initial decisions for non-extension of the contract are confidential. However, subsequent decisions are made in public. There are some other minor changes in the bill, such as moving the date for contract non-extensions from March 15th to April 1st.
Commissioner Gardner? In Section 5 of the bill, it is lines 27 and 28, you say an assessment of the effectiveness of the teacher in producing individual student achievement growth is how you're going to evaluate. What is that and how do you make that evaluation?
This particular bill doesn't specify the nature of the assessment. As Senator Durfer opined, as part of the process of evaluation, you need to take a look at what is the job of the teacher and then how well they're doing that job. I think one of the advantages of this particular language is that it allows each district to set those individual standards and methods of assessment. So it's up to the individual district when they identify their performance standards for each of their staff, what exactly they want to look at in terms of student achievement.
So in other words, it's clearly undefined. It could be anything.
It could be and should be a system and an assessment process that is generated through the statute. Well, through this section of the statute, 342.850, and it describes a process that is identified or started by the board with the input from teachers represented by their representative, as well as administrators in the district. And the superintendent then is charged with identifying what that process is. And that's the way we currently have it now. We don't have one evaluation system for teachers or administrators throughout the state. Each individual district identifies what that system is to meet their own needs based on their own job descriptions and their performance standards.
Further questions at this point?
You done?
Do you have a question?
Well, I guess
we'll go ahead and go ahead.
I want to know that.
You got interrupted that for Richard Gardner's question. I thought we got for anyone else.
I guess I'm still trying to figure out what the heart of this bill is. Are you saying what we passed in 880 last session basically didn't have enough punch and therefore we need more punch? You need more punch? You need something else or something something that we passed last session?
I don't think I would put it that way. That comment may be more directed to 1181 rather than to 1180. I think what 1180 is trying to do is to enhance the accountability link between performance and expectations and student achievement that was started in 880. So in that extent, you have to take another step in that process.
tightens up the process.
Pardon?
Tightens up the process.
Yes, it does tighten up the process. The collective bargaining changes were not something that was anticipated in Senate Bill 1180 at all. It was more a reflection of the current situation. The process for the dismissal of teachers is really also a product of what's been going on with the current situation. And it's really asking the question that Senate Bill 880 didn't really address, which is, what process should we have across the state for the dismissal of teachers? Should we have the same standard for all? Should we have the same appeal processes for all? And really, 880 didn't address that issue at all.
And this bill, Mr. Chair, does that. It provides uniformity.
Yes, it does.
Well, something, and this, when 880 was on the floor last session, and I guess I still have very strong feelings about this, and that is, if this is viewed as a carrot, or a stick, as many would say it is, just in along with 880, then what's the carrot? What is the other side? If we're providing incentives for people to get in this profession, I think accountability is a good idea. Student performance maybe is a good measurement. But where's the other side of this? Where's the other hand? And then perhaps you believe that the other hand is already there, but I would suggest that that's not the case. So, can you comment on that?
Frankly, I think the carrot and stick analogy is not complex enough. What I think this bill does is it focuses more on what the ultimate job of teachers and administrators are and creates a statutory statement that you're going to be evaluated on what your core function of your job is. Now, in conjunction with that, we have really clarified what the purpose of that evaluation is. It's not just to determine the performance of somebody's responsibilities, but it's also to make continual professional growth. So from that perspective, by focusing on what the ultimate job of the teacher administrator is, and combined with saying that we want you to make continual professional growth, we're going to identify ways that you can do your job better. So I think that's important from a public policy point of view, and it's certainly important from an individual teacher's point of view or an individual administrator's point of view. It's certainly important from the board point of view. Secondly, the collective bargaining changes and the dismissal process for teachers is not a carrot or stick approach because the protections for teachers have remained the same. 880 didn't change them. This bill doesn't change them. But what it does say is it creates a public policy about what is the statutory or public policy preference for those dismissals. Should we be holding the same standards for all? Should the appeals of teachers be the same for all? Should the process itself be a public process, or should it be a private process? So it doesn't really lend itself to a carrot and stick approach in my mind.
I guess just to comment on that, I guess I don't agree with that, because if you're suggesting that how 880 works and, well, 30 teachers didn't get an extension on their and maybe that's too low in your mind. Maybe you want 100. I don't know. But whatever the target was under 80, who knows?
I don't believe there was a target.
That's an unfair characterization to be trying to eliminate a certain number of teachers. I think you can understand what you said.
But I guess my sense of where this is going, and again, I think accountability is fine. But I just disagree that if you're going to suggest that there's a performance measurement, if you're in the private sector, if you do well, you typically get rewarded. And I would suggest that we I'm really anxious for 881 because Mr. Marshall has been in this building along with many of us asking for more money for school. Combining these two, I'm not sure what it is that we're going to achieve if in the end we're going to limit the amount of money that can go to school districts, as 881 potentially could, and combine that with some mechanism to basically require teachers to do more with potentially less. And I think that's currently the situation. So I'm not sure how these two married provide any more benefit to the school boards or to the school system. I just have yet to figure out how these two work. And I still believe the carrot and stick is still there because we're not certainly sending signals that if you do a good job, what's the reward? If you don't gain performance, then you potentially can be taken out of the system. Maybe that's fine, but there's got to be something on the other side. And I don't see it. Particularly if you put 881 together, which may, quite frankly, reduce the resources, which I'm interested to hear why you don't think that's going to be the case. That's just my
opinion. 1181.
1181, excuse me.
You didn't say 881.
1181. Tell me that.
And help me out here if I'm wrong. 1181 doesn't affect how much we allocate from here, does it?
No.
It can't have any effect on reducing that resource.
But one of the things that 1180 does do is, as Representative pointed out, in the private sector, we have a connection between pay and performance. In the public sector, that connection is often very diffuse. What this will do, however, is we'll start to look at, well, what are the performance aspects of the job do we value? By making a statutory statement, we're saying that student achievement is a very valued outcome. It's not going so far as to saying that a teacher's pay should be dependent upon that specific performance, or even a positive evaluation should be based on that specific performance. But that just part of that evaluation process, in combination with job description and performance standards, we should be looking at student achievement results. And we should be looking at how effective the teacher is in producing those results. Secondly, I think that there is a connection between 1180 and 1181. But the connection is probably not as obvious as one would expect. It's a method of accountability, but it's an accountability at a different level. Where 1180 in part focuses on the dismissal processes, it also focuses on individual accountability for the job that they're being paid to do. 1181 focuses accountability on more of a macro level. And it's at the district level that that accountability really starts to fall. So that, in a sense, 1180 and 1181 are complementary because they address different sections or different areas in the whole accountability system for schools.
This is Devlin.
Since we seem to be going back and forth between 1180 and 1181 and the bill from the last session, I should continue that. Part of the debate in the last session, as I remember it, and I was not that closely involved in any committee, but a lot of people were always asking the question about, well, if you're having talking about dismissal standards, what kind of evaluation process that you have, and how you go through some sort of progressive progressive discipline process, all this. And part of the reaction we got back from testimony in the building here was that we basically had problems evaluating teachers in the sense of people didn't have the skills to do the evaluation, they didn't have the time to do the evaluation, and that's why we couldn't have a more clear standard for what should be the real standard for dismissal or not. But how has that changed in the sense of you're talking about you're setting up clear standards, but part of the testimony we were receiving in the last session was the reason we couldn't put in place some of those tougher standards for dismissal, which I mean, once if you're advocating, was that you didn't have the resources to do that level of evaluation.
One of the least talked about impacts of Senate Bill 880 has been the impact of the revision of teacher and administrator evaluation systems in the state. One of the things that 880 did was to change some of the structure of evaluation and really kind of took off the handcuffs on how we evaluate our contract teachers. For some teachers, for instance, who are master teachers, you may want to put them on a professional development plan and do, say, a 3 or 4 year cycle, because their skills are already there and more self-directed activities are what the research says is appropriate. On the other hand, you may have teachers who are either in their probationary period or just coming out of their probationary period that you may want to continue an annual evaluation on. The changes in 880 allowed that type of flexibility of the district. When we've looked at what's happened to districts as they started to relook at their evaluations, about 48% of districts as a result of 880 started to relook at their evaluation plan. Now also at the same time, we were looking at some advances in teacher evaluation processes itself, some that are coming out of the Education Testing Service, and Charlotte Danielson has done some absolutely superb work in creating a framework for teaching so that our evaluations are much more precise. And of those 48% of districts that are that have revised their evaluation system, about 35 to 40% have started to incorporate those. In addition, OSBA, in conjunction with COTA, is working on doing some statewide training of administrators on these new systems. And in fact, our first major training is going to be in August of this year. So we've actually done quite a bit on improving the whole technology and methodology of doing teacher evaluations of the state.
But in terms of the existence of measuring results for accountability, I realize that they've taken away this clear tie between performance and the evaluation performance of students. This is the kind of bill that probably would have been best dealt with in a committee devoted to education, and about should have come, if it's well thought out, it should come to I don't believe it was well thought out, but it just came in the suit of Senate about February and later about March. My perception in my school district is, you have to get to the high school level before you have more than really one administrator in the building, on average. If we're going to put these standards in, how are you going to actually measure relative teacher performance? I mean, in the sense of if you're holding teachers accountable for results, how are you going to know what the changes have been in their classroom, what the differences are between the students they had this year versus the students they had last year?
One of the ways that the bill talks about, the specific language of the bill talks about individual student growth. So if you're talking about what a third grade teacher did this year and what a third grade teacher might do next year, we're really talking about individual student growth. And that then, I mean, the educational term is, within the context of the classroom. In other words, who are the specific individual students, what type of diversity, how many TAG students do you have, how many ESL, English as Second Language students, what do your pre-tests, when they come into the class, what are their skill levels? What are their skill levels when they leave the class? What ability, what type of progress has that individual student made? That's all, again, within the term called the context of the classroom. Now, interestingly enough, actually, Oregon is a leader in that type of technology and methodology. Western Oregon University has something that they call teacher work sample methodology, that they've integrated as part of their teacher training program that examines that very issue. That looks at not only, does the teacher know how to construct the lesson plan, is the lesson plan related to the curriculum, can the person implement the lesson plan, but then it takes that next step. How effective is that particular lesson plan, the choices that that individual teacher makes in producing student achievement growth for those specific students within that classroom and given that specific situation. But we actually have, in fact, it's a nationally recognized program and one of the few that are in the nation at this time that is looking at that very type of methodology.
Mr. Chairman, I have some more questions about 1181, but I think we're going to hear more testimony on 1181. Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll just ask one basic question then. 1181. That's just two basic questions. I'll combine them.
Same thing for two or four.
Our previous testimony from Senator Durfer and Senator Bryant was that the process in 1181 where they did separate sort of offering compliance with whatever draft figure had been given, they were indicating that they thought it would be a relative rarity when a school district actually imposed that. In what you provided the committee, you're referring it to as a safe harbor, as if something that school districts might be more apt to provide because it would basically put something on the table so that they may not have to go through a protracted process of collective bargaining on not only economic issues but other issues. My question is a pretty broad question, and that is, I look at the connection between local control and schools and local support as all being tied together. The more that we give school boards less interaction at the local level, I mean, we've talked about here about this is giving them a safe harbor. Senator Bryant and Senator Burke were very open about, well, maybe this isn't really good enough. Maybe we should just go to statewide bargaining. That's a further erosion of what you would be able to do at the local level. We are more and more prescribing what you do at the local level in terms of that. Aren't you at all concerned that with all these things, we're really going to start to erode that connection between the public and their schools, given that my district may be an average? I've been told in my district I only have about 25% of the electorate that has students in schools. And once that electorate starts to lose any connection with those schools even further, believing that they already believe they don't have much control over what occurs in their schools anymore, that you're going to end up with really some much broader problems than what we're talking about here. I think there are a lot of us that would like to see that local control aspect maintained. And people seem to be coming up more and more to take it away. And then we seem to be at the same time imposing more and more requirements on you to take it away.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, for your record, John Marshall. Representative Devlin, you've asked a broad question, so with your permission, I'll give you a broad answer. I'd like nothing more than to go back to the good old days, where the legislature provided 30 to 35, upwards of 40% in some years of our operating costs, and then we went and talked to our local communities about what they wanted their schools to be and how much they were willing to pay for them. Unfortunately, Oregonians made a pretty strong statement in 1990 that they didn't want the primary funding source of their school system to be local property taxes. So what we're dealing with now is what I term the new reality. And that is the legislature is now providing 70% of our operating resources. They control nearly 95% of our operating resources. And at the same time, you've imposed on the system some of the most ambitious academic standards for our students in the country. So the issue is, given limited resources, how can we best allocate those resources to get the job done, which is enhancing student achievement? Does Senate Bill 1181 create a cap on teacher salaries? Not necessarily. It can be, but it doesn't have to. Does Senate Bill 1181 build some fences around that process that don't currently exist? Absolutely. And I think if you look at the data, what we're seeing is that we have a limited amount of resources. And in a partial response to a question that Representative Edwards asked, I wish that I could look back on the last decade and point to adequate funding of schools, and if that were the case, then I doubt very much that we'd be here today talking to you about the need for Senate Bill 1181. But unfortunately, and I think there's data to show it, Oregon, the legislature has made what I would term a disinvestment given the state of our economy. And we'll continue to work to try to correct that and argue with you about why you should.
Mr. Marshall.
Sir.
And I know
note, still a comment from Senator Dirk Bryant, I think, that says Oregon pays our teachers more than 11 Western states pays their teachers, and yet you call that a disinvestment?
I would argue, Mr. Chairman, that in terms of the operating revenue that school districts have had to run schools, that we haven't kept pace on a per-student basis, we have not kept pace with inflation. Your question, however, leads to the issue, I think, on the table and why we're bringing you Senate Bill 1181. Given the fact that we have a limited amount of resources, the question is, how do we allocate those dollars? The data suggests that given this limited amount of resources, a larger and larger share of it has gone to teachers' salaries and benefits. And we're suggesting that given that fact, that leaves less that we can hire new staff to reduce class size, to hire the professional staff we can bring on to improve curriculum, the counselors that many students need, and I could go down the list of the things that we ought to have in schools to deal with the diversity of students that we have today that's a great deal different than it was just 10 years ago, as well as spend the resources that we need to try to get our kids to the standards that this body has, the standards, to the standards that this body set. So the issue is, limited amount of resources, how can we as locally elected officials who want to be accountable, and we're certainly going to be held accountable for how well our kids are going to do, how can we manage those resources to create more dollars that can go into program while trying to get a handle on the portion that goes to personnel costs. And that's the fundamental reason that we bring Senate Bill 1181. Absolutely.
I
just had one short follow-up. The question was asked, I believe, to Senator Dirk and Senator Bryant. The comment, you made a comment later about their testimony, that, okay, you take this figure from Dan, and we're saying that if you don't stay within that figure, then you file all of this documentation saying why you didn't. But at the same time, if I just get your comment, we're not saying to you that if you take this figure from DAS and you stay within that figure, that in the next biennium we're going to appropriate funds equivalent to that figure. That's your understanding, isn't it?
That's correct, Representative Devlin, yes.
So if DAS says you should have 4% per year or 3.8%, there's no guarantee that you're going to get that figure reflected in the following year's appropriation, the following biennium's appropriation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, it's my understanding, and I assume that DAS would come up with a figure that's based not only on projected CPI, hopefully projected other projected aspects of personnel costs, for example, the contributions we make to PERF, the cost of family medical benefits, et cetera, but they'll also look at that in the context of anticipated revenue. And so what we're doing, I think, is in effect, is creating a current service level system for school districts that we don't currently have, that is having some anticipation of what the resources are going to be and how we're going to be forced to operate within those, and then make local decisions about whether or not the demands from our employee unions are going to fit within those available resources. And I would submit that if that trump card is in the hand of a school board, that the demands brought to the table are going to be a little bit more reasonable, knowing that we may at any time play that card. And as I said, I think it creates senses around the collective bargaining process, and it also, I believe, changes the entire environment of that collective bargaining process. As was suggested in some testimony from an individual that we brought in from Wisconsin when this bill was on the Senate side to discuss their experience with the QEO that they have.
Thank you, my colleagues have referenced some of the testimony given by the two previous senators who testified on it. They also said that your school board members are spineless and don't do a good job. Do you agree with that?
Elected officials don't always necessarily make the best decisions. Representative Gardner. I think they make decisions based on a political environment. And if you can imagine a volunteer individual who don't make as much for their public service as you folks do, these volunteer individuals in communities are, there's just a great deal of political pressure brought to bear. I'm not sure I'd describe them as spineless, but I would describe them as wanting labor peace in their communities and maybe not really having the ability to stand up given that kind of political pressure that's brought in many communities. Anything to add to that? In this
sense? Okay. Representative Edwards, a lot of questions. Why, I guess, this is where I'm still grappling, and because you and I have been arguing in this building, it is a amount of resources we need to put into the pot. Because I think that's exactly right. In fact, you're well aware of an effort in this building over the interim that says we should be spending roughly, but now if we want to get performance to about $5.6 billion, and that's probably short, if you ask me, at least if you can try to implement it. So given that, how are we going to achieve any level of funding, even close to that, with 1181? Because as I see that, that's an outcome. Now we may, I mean, that's exactly right, we may never appropriate what gas comes up with the cap, with the theoretical cap. There's nothing in this bill that ties any appropriations with, which I think is a flaw. I mean, maybe the cap is high enough, I guess it wouldn't really matter, but it seems to me as long as you have some funding to it. I don't understand how you can be in here telling me that we need more resources, and yet I see this as basically a way to limit resource overall. I don't see that the proponents here are the ones who are arguing for more money. That's probably the exact opposite. So how do you solve that problem? I mean, how does 881 help us move down the path of getting towards at least the $5.6 billion in a relatively reasonable amount of time?
Representative Edwards, I would suggest that 1181, if used properly, will give us the evidence to bring to the legislature that shows that we've been able to hold down our personnel costs. The personnel costs are not eating up our budget. Yet the resources that we have after allocating the proportionate share of that budget to personnel costs is not enough to reduce the class sizes where it ought to be. It's not enough to provide the special programs for the kids that need it most. It's not enough to get the counselors back so that there's a reasonable number of kids to deal with. It's not enough to get the curriculum specialists in to improve curriculum so that we can really deal with student achievement in a responsible way. And I think it gives us cause to argue that the resources aren't adequate. Now, in some quarters, we argue that you've got to give us more money, and they say, well, why? You'll just give it away to his existing staff. You won't use it to reduce class size like you think you should. You won't use the dollars for those other things. And I think an approach such as this, again, I would expect very few school districts to actually impose the allowable growth factor, but I think that will begin to limit the portion of our budget to go for that and give us the evidence to make our case in sessions down the road.
Well, I think the evidence is already there, and I don't think it's necessarily a negotiation. Something you passed out to from the School Board Association about where contracts for teachers have settled, for example, for the last 9900. You know, their range from the low is zero, so no one's getting an increase, up to, I think, 4.25. Now, I don't think that is in any way out of sync, particularly if you look at what's inflation. So I guess I'm trying to still wrestle with, maybe it's just a difference in philosophy. I don't think, and quite frankly, if you want to look at it from your perspective, you have held down the cost if that's your concern with salaries. So what is the beef? I mean, I don't think I trust what you say, if you say what you're saying, which is you hold down the cost, which I think you've already done, you come in this building and you ask more resources for certain things that you can get them. I argue we're doing that right now, and it's been a heck of a struggle just to get to an adequate budget so we don't at least cut districts at service levels that are already straining. So I don't feel this advances the ball, which you and I both have been trying to advance this building. I don't disagree, but somehow I just don't see it.
Just from a technical point of view, the data that you're referring to is from our negotiations update and indicates settlements that we've so far reported for 99-2000.
Right.
The average is about 2.56% increase. That does not include the step increases that teachers would be eligible for. Those step increases, when I've looked at 98-99 salary schedules, they look like they're more around 3.8%. In fact, some of the information that we passed out earlier indicated a range of, say, 2.5 to 5. I actually went through and looked at some about 104 schedules, and it's a little bit higher than I had thought. It's 3.8% plus that 2.5%.
And this is something I raised with the senators, which is, isn't this like the ultimate, in an affront to local control? Because in essence, the state is saying, hey, you now, here's something that you can use, and I still am struggling with, if you don't use this factor, then you got to report it, and I'm still not sure what happens if you report it. You got 30 days before you can ratify the contract. I don't know if there's some way that contract could then be pulled back. I'd be interested to know if you have a comment on that. But it seems to me this is this huge affront to what you guys have been arguing to us, which is, hey, we want local control. Give us the money and we'll spend it wisely. This is saying, this is all basically you can negotiate, and that's all. And if you go over it, something else, you've got to start reporting it. You're doing something, and I still don't know what the reporting is supposed to do, but other than to say, hey, we broke the law, we broke this stemming, this cap. But to me, it seems like just flying in the face of the arguments that you've been making in this building.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, you're absolutely right. It makes my stomach churn to think that we're actually here promoting this scheme. I'd love to go back to the old days, but we're not there. I mean, the state now controls 95% of our operating resources. They're providing 70%. They control 95%. The fundamental struggle that we've got is how to balance the rights of local citizens and their communities to make decisions about the two most important resources that most communities have, their kids and their money, and the rights of the legislature, who's now providing the bulk of the funds, to have a better handle on how those funds are spent. And we can either put on the blinders and say, boy, wouldn't it be great to go back to the pre-1990 days when we had local control defined as financial autonomy. We don't have that anymore. So on one end of the spectrum, we've got the good old days. On the other end, we've got people talking about, well, if we really want to get a handle on how you school districts are spending your money, we'll take it over. We'll have a statewide salary schedule, and we'll have bargaining. And we say that's not wise politically, it's not wise practically. So on those two ends of the spectrum, where is it that we can go to get a handle on the balance between what we want to do and what you folks expect us to do? And so we just decided that Senate Bill 1180 is an appropriate middle ground between those two extremes.
1181,
excuse me, yes.
So how do we solve your problem?
Am I allowed, Mr. Chairman, to mention a proposed appropriation of the state school fund for the next 2 years?
Everybody else is proposing. You might as well propose one, too.
495, and we'll go home.
495. So if you can do that within existing resources.
We have it, Mr. Chair.
answer. Let's negotiate.
Just a will. Let's just do it here, Mr. Chair. This is relating to education. We can just stuff it in here.
I'm going to cut in human resources and health plan. Health plan doesn't have to go to do that. And we'll settle and go home.
Mr. Chair, I think there's about 20 people someplace in the building doing it right now.
If there's just a top two of us here, we could probably get it done.
Make me change for a day, I'll solve all the problems.
I think the bottom line here is that within the current funding scheme for education, we cannot continue to allow the price tag to be set at the local level and then hand the state the bill. Over time, it's going to head us into a train wreck. And this is just one little tool that allows the local negotiators a little more flexibility and option, the trump card, that they can play if they have to. And then I think we encourage good faith bargaining and probably a less adversarial approach at the local bargaining table.
Mr. Chair, one last point.
Yes, Representative Edwards.
I mean, I just reminded you, too, that this bill affects other people than just teachers.
Yes.
It was brought to us yesterday, too. So yes. It isn't just about teachers, which
that's correct.
Seems to be the focus of today.
Just one last question, Chair. You mentioned Wisconsin, and this has been mentioned as just a tool that could be used. In Wisconsin, how often is it used?
Lee Allen, when he was testifying on the Senate side, Lee Allen is a school board member from Wisconsin, from Madison, indicated that during the last year, out of the 423 districts, 6 districts used the TUIO. That's about 1.4% of districts.
Representative Gardner, Senator Durfler, in his testimony today, said Wisconsin used the optional economic, the qualified economic proposal 20% of the time. And what context that was in, I don't know.
I'm not sure what context Senator may have been talking about during the period from 1993 to 2009, as opposed to the last year. I do remember Mr. Allen testifying that that was the number that he used last year.
Last year's negotiations, how much?
Well, they negotiate every 2 years.
Right.
The last annual was 6 out of 423 districts.
Covered me. Okay. Yesterday, we heard from OEA and OSEA, and they wanted to have just a few moments to come up and testify after you both finish. So stand by if you would, and we'll allow them to come up and have 5 minutes, please, to testify. And if you want to come back, we'll give you the same option.
Closing
arguments, counter arguments, and every whole kind of arguments going on. And Representative Edwards stepped out, but also, as I mentioned earlier, Sarah Gates from Dance is standing by to answer questions about how the numbers in 1181 are established. And what we'll do is have you come up shortly. Thank you. Okay. Clock's running.
My name is Mark Toledo. I'm here again representing the Oregon Education Association. I'd like to respond to a few of the things raised by the Oregon School Board Association today and by Senators Durfler and Bryant. With all due respect for those folks, we respectfully disagree with their assessment of what 880 did or did not do in 1997. I also want to comment on the suggestion that the school boards are somehow undermanned or lack power in bargaining. They responded to some questions, and in fact, most of the school boards that bargain around the state or have more complex bargaining situations have hired attorneys or have hired OSDA representatives such as Mr. Wilson or I think Lisa Fraley from the Oregon School Board Association to help them bargain. Nancy Hungerford, Bruce Zager, John Whitty, and other attorneys who help do this. Donna Cameron, the Mill and Nash Law Firm, does this. When Portland School District bargained this year, members of their board included Ron Saxon, an experienced attorney. I know that one of the school board members in the past over at the Corvallis School District was the Human Resources Director for Hewlett-Packard. So school boards, while they may have citizens and folks out there, I think are being unfairly criticized for their inability to argue, and I think to bargain effectively. They do it, and they do it consistently, and they have professional people to help them do it. With respect to Senate Bill 880, the changes, the bill changing many parts of the fair dismissal law in 1997, that bill did not have as a main concern doing away with the right of teachers to bargain just cause. As a practical matter, most contracts or most teachers' associations do not bargain that because they do use the Fair Dismissal Act. And in those cases where teachers such as those in Fern Ridge have bargained for just cause as a way of dealing with dismissals, it is used as an alternative. They either choose just cause arbitration to deal with their dismissal, or they choose the statutory fair dismissal process. So they've chosen one or the other. To remove the option, the possibility for them to bargain this, takes away local control, things that a number of districts have bargained around the state without a strike. I suggest that to come back here, as OSBA is doing now, to try to remove something from the bargaining process because it has been an issue of a strike will be an endless process, and you will see something every legislative session asking you to remove something from what teachers can bargain about because there has been a strike over that. It's not fair. It's not the way other public employees are treated, and it will not provide a unified system in bargaining for all public employees. I also want to say that with respect to the fair dismissal statute in the state, in 1997, there was a uniform fair dismissal statute. The fair dismissal statute provides 9 statutory reasons for dismissing permanent or contract teachers now, people who have some job security, inadequate performance, neglect of duty, insubordination, immorality, and so forth are the statutory reasons that apply to all contract teachers in the state. In 1997, there was a uniform system for dismissals under the Fair Dismissal Law. And in that system, people or local districts and their bargaining agents could bargain for just cause rather than the statutory method of dismissal, and a few of the states have done that. A very small percentage have done that, and they should have the right to do that as an alternative if they think that will be a better way of handling dismissal cases on a local basis. Frankly, just cause is the main way that most employees have their dismissal cases handled. The classified employees in school districts typically and generally have just cause for dismissal. That is how their dismissal is handled. But the proposal by the Oregon School Board Association would take that right away from school teachers. The proposals by the Oregon School Board Association or by that would be covered by Senate Bill 1180 would largely go back to the system we had in 1997 before 880 was passed. And as I indicated yesterday, it is preferable for school boards, for school districts, for teachers, for all involved, that we settle on some system and allow it to work for a while instead of move back and forth every other year. There are a couple of questions that were asked yesterday. I want to clarify with respect to Senate Bill 1181. Representative Starr asked a question about the Portland CTI I referenced yesterday, and I passed out a handout that was the basis for the compilation of data that we had for you to review. But the Portland CTI is the only CTI available in Oregon, and it includes Yamhill, Clark, Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas counties in calculating the Portland Consumer Price Index. And I indicated that the percentage of growth in employment wages for elementary and secondary schools was 33.5% during the eight-year period 1989 to 1997, and that's below the Portland CPI increase for that same period of time. That figure, the 33.5%, includes step increases. It includes step increases, as I indicated yesterday, I believe it did. And part of the reason that figure is what it is because not everybody gets step increases. Depending upon the number of steps on a salary schedule, people who reach that top level stop getting them. So there is a balance in the system that prevents excessive salary increases. I want to return for a minute to Senate Bill 1180. Mr. Wilson indicated that the provision that would remove the right or make just cause a permissive item of bargaining does not change protection for teachers. It does change protection for teachers. It does change collective bargaining rights they currently have. It is a major change in the rights that teachers currently have. It's a right that classified employees in school districts have, and it's unfair to take that right away from teachers. One final point, I agree with Senator Bryant that Oregon schools are doing a great job. Oregon public education is doing a great job with the resources they have right now. Oregon's juniors have the highest SAT scores in the country in the last year. Oregon schools are expected to meet the education reform standards adopted, I believe, in 1991. They're doing that even though the legislature has not appropriated the funds that they said they should have to meet those standards. Teachers are deserving of the salaries they get. They're the ones that are necessary to implement school reform. The teachers write curriculum. Teachers have class sizes of 30 to 45 or more. Teachers counsel troubled students. Teachers are dealing with the disabled students that are included now in regular classes. Teachers are dealing with coming home bruised, physically bruised in dealing with those types of students. Dealing with the special ed students is one of the most challenging aspects of education today. Teachers are the ones who put on band-aids, they're the ones that break up fights. We are not embarrassed to suggest that teachers, as the person who spends 7 hours a day with students, are be paid an appropriate wage, and they are. For that reason, we again ask that you oppose Senate Bills 1180 and 1181.
Thank you. Chris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, and my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, representing classified school employees in this case, K-12 and ESD. I have a couple of points to make. The first deals with some questions that you asked me yesterday regarding step increases. Our union has not done a statewide salary survey in a couple of years, so I can't answer your questions definitively for the most recent periods of time. But I would like to make a couple of points about step increases for classified. Classified starting salaries at the bottom step are not market. The steps are intended to encourage classified to stay in their jobs, to stay with the school district by giving them a raise that they can count on each year up to the top step. The Department of Education estimates that the turnover rate for classified school employees is 25%. For those of you that are in business, if your turnover rate was 25%, you'd be looking at what the problem is that you can't keep employees. It's very important to school boards to obviously maintain an experienced, stable workforce to the best of their ability. Hence, steps. Steps are to bring classified staff and probably teachers, but I can't speak for them, but to bring classified staff up to market. And so the step isn't a bonus, except if you consider it a bonus for sticking around, for gathering the experience that you need to be the best bus driver that you need to be for the school district, to be the best custodian or whatever it is that you do in your job. The steps are not they are a mutually beneficial way that school districts can, in a high turnover field, save money at the bottom and reward those that stick with them through the years in their jobs. And so it's not I think you should consider it something different than a base salary. Without steps, school districts would have to establish perhaps an entry rate for probationary employees and then a market rate for everyone else. That, I would suggest, would cost school districts a lot more money than they're currently paying for their staff, given the high turnover rate. And so steps are very beneficial for both management and for classified in our attempt to provide long-term employment for classified in schools. The other point, technical point I'd like to make is that I'd like you to, as you're considering what to do with this bill, on page 2, section 9 and 10 of Senate Bill, or lines 9 and 10 of Senate Bill 1181, if you think about how this would work given what you know about budgeting from your perspective, it says that this allowable growth factor shall reflect the current market conditions. It shall be within forecasted state revenues allocated past tense for school districts and ESDs. Then it goes on to require DAF to establish an allowable growth factor for the next 5 years. I don't know how you do that. No matter how good you are projecting and predicting numbers, how DAS can predict what you're going to allocate to schools, well, perhaps they can. If they can, then perhaps the school boards and OEA and OSDA and all of the rest of us need to go over to DAS and ask them what you're going to do next time. We can't tell what you're going to do this time. And I'm not sure DAS is any better at predicting that than any of the rest of us are. And I think that there are some very problematic. There is some very problematic language in this bill. Even if you like the concept, there is problematic language that needs to be addressed. So you're putting this in the law book. And I think that that's one of those things. I told you classified employees don't make a lot of money. And last night I got the figures for our current salaries in the schools across the state. Remember, classified employees are generally not 12-month year-round employees. Of the nearly 17,000 members that we have, under 4,000 of them are year-round employees. The rest of them are 9-month, 10-month, 11-month employees, and they are not eligible for unemployment, remember. So when they don't work, they don't work, they don't get any money. Our average gross monthly salary is $1,472. That is below the federal poverty level for a family of four. They are not being overpaid by schools. And I don't anticipate whether you pass this bill or not that they will be overpaid by schools in the future.
Your average includes bus drivers who work part-time?
Our bus drivers typically work full-time, not part-time. But some of them do work part-time. And this is our average, yes. As I was listening to the proponents express the reasons for Senate Bill 1181, I heard that elected officials don't always make the best decisions. Frankly, school boards can't bargain effectively. Then I heard that in response to a question, how will 1181 really change any of that, the response was, if used properly. I would suggest to you that if the collective bargaining process that's in place right now is used properly, that there is not a need for this bill. Collective bargaining is a balanced process. OSEA just organized classified in the Perrydale School District, a very small school district. They began their bargaining process for their first contract recently. And those classified employees with their OSCA field representative will be bargaining with school board members and Mr. Jim Sager, who is a contract lawyer who bargains all over the state for school districts. To say that poor little elected officials on school boards just don't have a chance against the unions is just simply not accurate. And I hope that you aren't swayed by that argument, because that's not what's happening out there, and I believe that our salary ranges reflect that. I heard also that this bill was necessary to convince you that they're doing the right thing with their resources, and it isn't their fault that you won't give them enough money. Well, if we're in another room in this building, I'm there arguing that same point. You don't give them enough money for textbooks, for class sizes, for all the other needs, for 21st century school reform and the mandates that you've put forward on schools. But to blame the staff and to insinuate that they are overpaid and have too much power over their supervisors and their managers, I think is a dodge that you shouldn't spot. And I hope that with that, that you will reject this idea and go back for something else.
Good question. What's in that?
Thank you. I also asked about the idea of moving to statewide collective bargaining, and you kind of deferred to responding because you needed to get some further feedback. Have you gotten any further feedback?
My board did not meet overnight, Representative Mamet, so I don't have an official position on statewide collective bargaining. However, I did express to you that I felt that there is a large disparity in salaries between different parts of the state, and I think that for classified staff, particularly, and particularly those outside of the metro area, if I polled them and they saw likely results, perhaps they would not, those individuals would not think that's a bad idea. We believe that the process we have right now with TUCPA is a good process. We understand the difficulty that you face. But it's a funding difficulty. It's not a difficulty with the staff in school. And so we would hope that we would deal with the funding difficulty.
Further question, Mr. Manning?
No, thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Edwards.
How does 880 affect you?
It does not. And 1180 does not affect
us. I mean, 1180. Excuse me. I'm sorry. I
know.
Last session, this session, these bills are sure. 11-8, no effect.
No effect on classified, only certified.
You don't have to have any performance. This is required.
We have a different process, Representative Edwards.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I would comment just, I think there is a difference between bargaining ability and the political will to hold the line and do the right thing for the district. I think it's just lame that we use school books as an excuse. Because the money is provided, you already go. And that just rubs me the wrong way. I think if management of the school is managing within resources appropriately and effectively, we won't have the old school books. And hopefully this will be one tool that would help them and encourage them in doing that. So thank you for coming. And,
thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Marshall or Mr. Brown, what's his name? Do you want to? I'll offer you the same opportunity. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Does the school board have a position on the governor's amendment to the bill?
Yes. I don't know. Do you want to comment on the governor's amendments to the bill?
Mr. Chairman, members, John Marshall with the School Board Association. We prefer Senate Bill 1180A that came over from the Senate. If you, in your wisdom, decide not to proceed with that, then we're willing to take a look at what the governor's proposed. But so as far as I can tell, Senate Bill 1180 and 1181 are still on the table.
Just to follow up on that, do you rather us pass the bill that came to the Senate and get a veto than get a bill that they're more fine?
I would like to see the Senate Bill 1180 and 1181 concepts on the table for further discussion.
Can I follow up on this?
Yes.
Are you in discussion with the governor's office on these bills so that we get a bill that we don't vote on something out of this committee that's going to be vetoed by the governor?
The discussions that we've had with the governor's office to try to make Senate Bill 1180 and 1181 satisfactory to his office are not currently going on. I would hope that the powers that be in negotiations would keep Senate Bill 1180 and 1181 alive.
written in that. Would it help spark discussions if we proposed to get in Stephanie's bills to do a referral to the people to establish statewide collective bargaining?
The question is, would I support your gutting and stuffing these bills to do statewide collective bargaining? The answer is no.
No, no, no. I said, would it help spark up the process a little bit if we did that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, it's my view that the process is sparked enough.
Now, what do you say on the 86th Amendment?
The 86th Amendment to Senate Bill 1181?
Yes.
We have no objections to those.
Okay. And they're also amendments to 1180 for those. They are the.
That's what I was looking for.
The 86th Amendment, sort of 1180, is the one that strikes the language about the assessment being based on effective student performance. And the other part of the 86 is just a technical thing about the hearings officer.
I think we would argue that a major piece of Senate Bill 1180 is to place in statute the importance of the effectiveness of a teacher in improving student achievement ought to be clearly a part of the evaluation process. I think that's an important piece of that bill, and we would not support your taking that out.
And before you leave, would you hazard a guess at what property taxes would be today if people had not made the decision they made in 89 to make a cut?
Mr. Chair, without my calculator, I'd have no way of projecting.
So the process that was in place was inherently flawed, and over time it would have run into a train wreck.
The process of schools relying on local property taxes for support.
The voters are going to say enough.
I think if those property tax limitation measures had not passed, I think we would be arguing that the more that you provide the schools through what we termed back then the basic school support fund would in fact serve as property tax relief.
Because we had
more
relief programs in the mid-80s. We had various sundry relief programs in place.
Well, the data suggests in those years when you made significant contributions to basic school support, that is, you moved the level of school support upward significantly, that property taxes actually stayed relatively stable. And in one year, as I recall, actually went down for school operating purposes. The point is there was a hydraulic between local support and state support. The more state support the legislature provided, the less pressure there was on the local property tax. And over the decade of the 80s, one way that we were able to stem the tide of those property tax limitations that started in California in 78 was to every 2 years increase the level of support that basic school support provided. There was a time, however, when that percentage started to decline. Schools were responding to some pretty heavy-duty inflation, and there was even greater pressure on local school district levies. Property taxpayers were put in the untenable position of significantly increase the property taxes on your house, or we have to make significant cuts, or in some cases even close the doors of schools. And that was, I think, the voters reacted finally to that pressure on the property tax by their vote in 1990, in addition to the fact that there was a view that the legislature had enough, had the money to deal with the problem, but for a variety of reasons they chose not to, and so they amended their measure, which in effect said, oh, we're going to phase this down, and we're going to cause the legislature to pick up the tab. So those folks that were concerned about making drastic cuts to schools that had consistently voted no on those property tax limitations measures all of a sudden had sort of a good conscience vote and voted yes, and it did pass, albeit narrowly. But it did pass, and surprisingly, it passed in the metropolitan area.
I don't personally consider those the good old days. And I do think we have a good school system in Oregon. And we've gone from one system that had its problems to another one that has its problems. But in the meantime, we've been able to maintain some pretty good schools.
Absolutely.
This has changed the debate and the arguments and where the debate takes place.
That's correct.
And be that as it may.
I think, Mr. Chair, if I could, part of that was in response to Representative Devlin's question that talked about the connection. I certainly don't want to go back to the situation of putting citizens in the position of increasing taxes on their homes or closing schools. But I think we all miss the connection that the levies, the tax-based elections in that discussion had in terms of connecting schools with communities. And I wish there was a way to get back to that, but I certainly agree that that kind of pressure and the untenable position it put a lot of our citizens in was unacceptable.
Representative Devlin.
Two basic questions. One, if we're talking about from a historical perspective here, the predecessors to Measure 5, it appeared to me that in most cases when those measures failed, the legislature responded by actually reducing the percentage of school costs that were covered, which drove up property taxes at the local level. Do you think we'd be better off now if they hadn't done that and brought it up to maybe a reasonable level of 40 or 50% at that time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, I couldn't begin to guess how that dynamic might have changed. I think had the legislature been more willing to increase its share, it might have created less pressure on the property tax. At the same token, the question is, what effect does that have on other areas of the state budget? And, obviously, that's a political discussion that was essentially the same back then as the one we're having today.
Mr. Chairman,
let's wrap this up.
Mr. Chairman, this is the final. Going back,
available, Mr. Chair, for personal counsel.
Okay, we might all need it, but I'm returning.
Mr. Chairman, I want to get this.
Okay, go ahead. No one holds you.
Let's compare that. You say that there's any similarity between that period of time when we lower the level of school support and the discussions that we currently now have, believing that there's some problem going to higher levels of school funding than we're talking right now about currently in the majority proposal about a 9% increase, when most state agencies are experiencing increases of between 18% to 20%.
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, very briefly, I think the most significant change in the discussion that's occurring today versus that that occurred in the past has to do with your decisions now affecting the marginal dollars that school districts have. It was never a discussion back in those days of class sizes, programs to the extent it is now, because back then you were dealing with 30 to 35% of our operating costs. Now you're dealing with 70 to 75% of our operating costs. So
I just thought it was kind of interesting that the current figure in the majority version is about an 8.7% increase, and that's about as high as we've been able to get to so far. But for some of the agencies, not including state parks, that has the average increase has been about 18 to 20%.
Quickly, Mr. Edwards.
I'm talking about the good old days. Actually, yeah, I tend to fall into this. I think since Measure 5 has been beneficial in schools, albeit we haven't stepped up to the plate to really meet the needs of schools, I think what the chair was getting at is districts like his and more minor and small districts that have natural resource bases that are no longer there. They have no tax base now. They had a helping on them. It's gone. And plus, they had the whole issue of putting in the school forms. It has standard funding. It makes some sense. But I do think there needs to still be a local option out there that we need to give school districts where they can supplement what we do fail to give, or at least complement what we do give. I wanted a clarification on 1181-3. You do support that? Is that what you said? The governor's dash 3? 1181? You said you didn't.
Representative Edwards, we would prefer 1181 as it currently exists. The one proposed amendment we would not object to, but our position is still supporting the bill that came over from the Senate.
And just to point of clarification, 1180 and 1181 are not being discussed with our side in the negotiating. So if you're having hopes about that, I'd dampen my fears. Hopefully this is the committee that will address it one way or the other.
Thank you. Quickly,
Oh, I thought these were the linchpins of the negotiations.
Thank you. Sarah Gates, would you come up and rescue us from this debate? Please. Representative Edwards is back in the room. I know he'll have some questions about this, what we call allowable growth factor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Sarah Gates, an economist for the Office of Economic Analysis, and I was asked to come here today to answer any questions you might have about this increased factor and what might be used to would be considered in determining. So I'll just answer questions.
Is it a black on the wheel of fortune where you spin it? Or is it more scientific? Pardon me?
We tried hard. No. In determining current service level for state government at the moment, for employee compensation, we tend to use the national CPI, which is the consumer price index. That is generally accepted as the best factor. For other types of goods and services, we use the GDP implicit price deflator, and there are other inflation indices that are used for things like medical costs. And then, of course, we do take into account things like roll-up of new programs or salary packages and things like that, determining the current service level.
Representative Edwards.
I guess I think all the questions I was making were on Section 3 of the bill. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've got that.
I do.
I guess to start off with, it would require you to calculate a factor for 5 years. Can you do that?
Mr. Chair.
With any accuracy, let's put it that way.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, we do a forecast out that is 6 years time horizon, and we base, depending on what industry you're talking about, our national data provider provides us with the U.S. CPI, the GDP, the price deflator, and the medical deflator. We do a forecast of the Portland CPI, and we give it our best unbiased estimate every time we do it.
Could you just comment on the accuracy? As farther out you go from year one, how much confidence do you have in the projection?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, the farther out in time you go in the forecast, it tends to converge to the long-term trend, so you don't have as much variation in the level. It tends to be sort of where it is averaged based on history. For example, our current forecast of the Portland CPI is hovering around 2.7-2.8% all the way out through 2005. The biggest changes from 1998 to 1999, and that's based on what all the national economists are thinking and what our office staff is thinking about what is happening to inflation. There's just no upward pressures at the moment that are major. We expect a little increase, but not a lot. So we're as confident as we can be in that number.
This is more accurate than prediction of the stock market, right?
Mr. Chair, we don't do a prediction of the stock market.
This particular question has been broadly interpreted by different speakers. Do you see within this question, not only looking at the potential growth in state revenues, the changes in the CPI, but also in looking at individual factors that might impact employee compensation, like health care and others? Do you see all of that within this one section?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, my understanding is, based on this bill, based on this version of the bill, we would look at all the economic factors that would go into affecting state and the compensation for school districts and education service districts. And we would take advice from people as to what the best factors are and do some research. Currently,
that would be cost and revenue.
Well, revenue forecast is done independently, as you know.
But in terms of developing a factor, you'd look at both costs and projected
right.
revenue.
And well, the revenue projections are consistent with our inflation projections. It's all done as a big two-part model. So the economics of the state are what drives the revenue model. So that would be taken into consideration.
Just one quick more. Mm-hmm. So let's say your revenue projections and your CPI projections, broad CPI, would not necessarily reflect the CPI for healthcare costs. It's usually at least double, if not triple, the normal inflation factor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jefferson, that is correct. But we do track the medical price deflator, and you are has increased much faster than general price levels. And if that were deemed a significant factor that's influencing the salary increases, then we would take that into consideration in developing factors.
Does this calculation also somehow incorporate property tax as well? I'm still forecasting state revenues allocated for school districts. Is that general fund moderate, or is that the whole package?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I don't have an opinion on what the bill is really saying, but state revenues, property taxes are local revenues. They are not considered part of the state revenues.
So then we get down to projecting to the personal income, which is what we at times I'll dash if that runs with that. And I guess that's that's not a personal person to you, but I think it just reflects how hard it is to be accurate with this. And I think if you talk to folks who are negotiating, contracts typically are longer than 1 or 2 years, and my point is the longer you go out, the more inaccurate this is going to be. So I'm not sure how valid you can, even if you create a fairly tight model, I'm not sure how accurate it's going to be, particularly 5 years. I don't, you struggle enough trying to predict what income's going to be, lottery, property taxes, and they all combine. So anyway, it's an observation.
Do you want to respond to that?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, that's a very correct observation. It has been a very difficult period in forecasting revenues because our state has undergone a period of really dramatic growth and then a rapid slowdown. We do give our best estimate every time, but over the long term, you are correct that we tend to converge towards the trend, and in the variation around that over the is a little bit more difficult to predict.
Would it be fair to say, though, that in negotiating pay raises for the future, others are also trying to do their own projections, and that they'll have a debate about that? And I'm not going to get you into the merits of the bill, but the point is you don't just look at past performance, you project for the future when you're negotiating a collective bargaining agreement for the future.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, I would assume that you would look towards the future as to what you expect costs to be and how they would impact wages or the cost of living. And this would be the best estimate that's available for, in terms of what those costs are going to be.
Thank you.
One last thing. I mean, again, not to pin you down on this bill, but it talks about total combined compensation. Obviously, for benefits, which we have experienced, has also been surprising. There are lots of things here. It makes, I guess, again, Section 3, I think, is going to be very hard for you to put something out there that has a level of confidence. It's my observation. A lot of factors here that go into this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, whatever factors put out there, all the assumptions behind it would be laid out, and so it would be very clear what it included and what it did not include and how those estimates were made.
I was just going to comment. Could I paraphrase something you said and see if it helps Representative Edwards?
Please, go ahead.
When you make a long-term forecast, that forecast is indeed more accurate than any subpart of the whole forecast. So you might forecast with growth as X percent over the next 5 years, but for any one of those years, it might be two times X or half an X. But overall, it's okay. The problem is, this is going on in the interim. So short term is off, long term is on. Is that?
That is correct. That over time, the long-term average growth will not change as much as the individual variation. And we've seen really sharp variation in our income, our general fund, recently as a result of a couple of kickers that we've had and the federal pension refunds. So at least on the revenue side, we've seen extreme variation from year to year, but the long-term average has not changed over the last 2 or 3 years significantly.
But the mechanics of this thing would be addressed, I mean, every year. I mean, who knows when they're going to be, and the fact is in place. And so, 1 year somebody is going to be using it, the next year they're going to go to the bargaining table, and some other district will be looking at maybe a different number, or maybe it's closer to them. But that might not necessarily, there may be dramatic changes that have happened in some of those single factors to build this, because I assume it's a rolling 5 years, is it not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, it just says of each of the next 5 years, and so if you do it on the first of the year, I would assume you would go forward 5 years each time. So.
Isn't that one of the things that we always need to sort of reverse our, what I call, initial instinct on, and that our instinct would normally be, gee, you can be more accurate with the short-term projection than you can with the long-term projection. But in economic analysis, when you're projecting the future, the reverse is true because of the averaging of factors over time, and I could even throw in climate as well as economy, but that our expectations are usually that I can be more accurate when I'm projecting for the next year, but an economic projection actually, because of the averaging, your projections over time are generally more accurate.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, I think that statement is, you could say that in recent history for Oregon, because we've had this period of exceptional growth in things like corporate income taxes, personal income taxes, employment, et cetera. But in periods where the economy is fairly stable, you should be able to have less difficulty predicting the short term as well, because your history would be a better indicator of what is going to happen in the future.
Mm-hmm.
It was very difficult for us to predict 10% growth in high-tech employment based on what had happened in the past. You all have been around for that, so you understand that. But if you had 2% growth year after year, your trend is more likely to be a good indicator.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions for Sue Gardner? Anything? Thank you for taking time to come over and visit with us today.
Oh, my pleasure, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate that.
If I can give any further assistance, do not hesitate.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Is she covered by the lobbying provision, Mr. Chairman?
not if she's invited. She's not.
I couldn't tell.
Yeah, invite all the testimony you want. Okay? I appreciate you watching that, the Representative Manning. We've got to watch that all the time. It's very important that we do so. We won't be meeting in the morning. Okay? In the morning, no. And the amendments and things just aren't ready yet. But we will be meeting tomorrow at 2. So we will take it up again tomorrow at 2 o'clock. And until then, we are adjourned.
What?